From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The San Francisco Jazz Festival begins tomorrow, and we'll take a trip through the history of jazz in the hour ahead with our focus on the jazz piano. We'll hear a lot of snippets of jazz pianists as we learn about the origins and varieties of America's indigenous music. Forum is next, with music both live and recorded, and your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Well, with the San Francisco Jazz Festival commencing tomorrow, we thought we'd move this hour through a compressed overview of jazz history, kind of the Ken Burns approach, but in 1 hour. We're going to focus on the jazz piano, and joining us for this jazz education, appropriately enough, is, well, jazz educator extraordinaire, and that's Corey Combs. He's director of education for SF Jazz. He teaches history of jazz piano, innovators, improvisers, and legends for SF Jazz. He's also a bass player and composer and heads the Great Plains Ensemble and will be appearing at the San Francisco Jazz Festival, which runs, by the way, through November 9th. And we welcome you.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here, and also glad to have Dee Spencer, who's here in studio with us, who directs the jazz program at San Francisco State and directs SF Jazz All-Star High School Ensemble. And she has her keyboard here, and she's ready to play. So we're going to hear some live music. Hi, Dee Spencer.
How are you?
Okay, glad to have you. And let's begin first before we go through this jazz history that we're ambitiously trying to do in this hour. We've got so many jazz aficionados who listen to this program that you know, have to be at top drawer, obviously,
I'm sure, as we always try to be.
But tell us a little bit about what's coming up for this 26th annual San Francisco Jazz Festival.
Well, this is a very exciting festival. We're starting this weekend and going through November 9th. This weekend we have two really unique shows that are at Davies Symphony Hall. We have Miles from India, which if you're not familiar with this group, which a lot of listeners aren't, it's a combination of a lot of alumni from the Miles Davis Band playing with East Indian musicians, and so they combine those two sounds to play some of Miles Davis's most famous compositions, and it's a very interesting mix of rhythms and improvisation, but still has this Miles Davis flavor along with the Indian improviser. So it's a great group, and Dave Liebman will be with them, and many of Lenny White, many of the great Miles Davis players.
Well, that's a good tease right there, the Miles from India group, and we'll find out more about what's coming up. But I want to hear some music. In fact, that's what this hour is all about. So let's hear Fats Waller first. We'll start with. That's That's Carolina Shout, and it's from the 1920s. It's an example of what they call stride music and a precursor, really, to the blues. Let's find out more from you, Corey, on that.
Well, the reason stride is really significant is it's a solo piano style, and I'm not a pianist, so I have, fortunately, Dee's here to... I definitely have a case of piano envy. I wish I played piano, so Dee's going to give us some live examples. But what was really significant about it is these pianists were having to play the role of the entire band, so oftentimes they wouldn't have a bassist or a drummer or a horn player. They would have to be the rhythm section and the melody, so it became very complicated in terms of what the left hand and right hand were having to do. So, Dee, can you give us an example of that left hand in terms of what stride pianists might do?
On my keyboard here at 10 a.m.
Corey's got the baton on you there,
Dee. Following Fats Waller. Sure. So the left hand will kind of go back and forth. And we call this motion striding. So that's basically the left hand hitting the bass and hitting the chords back and forth in sort of like a walking, striding motion.
Right. Yeah. That's it. Well, we're going to hear some more. Listen to this. This is Blind Lemon Jefferson.
I was standing on East Cairo Street one day. I was standing on East Cairo Street one day. Standing on East Cairo Street one day. One dime was all I had.
Well, of course, you can't often talk about jazz without talking about the blues, and this gives us a flavor of the blues, an influence we'll trace throughout the hour here.
Exactly.
Tell us about Blind Lemon Jefferson.
Well, there was a lot of guitarists that were from this, accompanying themselves, singers that accompanied themselves on guitar. They're traveling musicians. They weren't really considered just blues musicians. They were able to play ragtime. They were able to play spirituals. They were able to play, the popular music of the day. But as blues became very popular in the late 20s and 30s, they began to play the blues style. And what's interesting about it is when we talk about jazz music and how jazz music is has blues in it, it's very different than what we just heard, in that the guitarists would follow their vocal phrase, and they wouldn't follow a specific rhythm all the time, and they definitely wouldn't follow a specific form. So it wasn't what we really consider blues today. That's not what they were doing then. They were just really following the phrase. They were following the feeling of the song rather than so much the structure that we consider the blues today.
Well, that's from One Dime Blues, 1926. And as we move along, and we are kind of moving along here chronologically, as well as seeing the music morph and metamorphose and all that, this is a Boogie Woogie Stomp that we're going to hear a bit of next. And this is where blues and jazz begin to meld. It's from the 1930s. And we'll have Dee explain the blues structure to us so we can spot it even more as we go along. It's Albert Ammons and Meade Lux Lewis. Body's moving here in studio. Explain the blues structure to us. Can you do that?
Sure. Well, Corey, going to count this out for me while I play it?
Yeah, what we'll do is Dee will play through 12-bar, 12-measure blues form, and then I'll count through the measure so we can hear how it sounds to go from measure 1 to measure 12. And then once we're back at the beginning again, it just repeats ad nauseum. So
here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4. 2, 3, 4, 5, 3, 4, 6, 2, 3, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and then we're back to the beginning again. And why don't you play?
He's not only a jazz educator, he can count.
I can count. Yeah. I can count very well. You wouldn't have known. But what's important about that, and the reason, while that might seem a pedestrian example, the reason it is important is because form is really the introduction into a deeper understanding of a jazz performance. So if you can start to recognize some of these song forms, like the blues and the AABA structure, which is the Tin Pan Alley and Broadway songbook uses almost exclusively, you can really start to understand what these musicians are doing, and it's not so mysterious that, okay, they're just repeating this maybe 35 times in a song, but it's not as if it's just made up. They do whatever they want the whole time, which is sometimes a misconception about jazz.
The misconception is that jazz is all improvisational, or it's all made up on the spot, or that sort of thing. And here we're finding out just to what extent that is not the case. And now we've come to one of the greats in jazz history, Count Basie. And we're at 1938. We're talking about swing, which really moves through the 30s, but Basie straight out of the blues. And this is Jumping at the Woodside. We're going to hear this and get some of Dee's accompaniment here to point out some of the things about the piano that made Count Basie so unique as he was.
Thank you.
Jumping at the Woodside makes you want to get up on a ballroom and go at that kind of swing dance, doesn't it? Dee, tell us about, really, again, what makes Count Basie so unique?
Well, Count Basie is part of that Kansas City tradition, which is the blues riff tradition. It's an oral tradition. So a lot of the big bands played by ear. And what they did was they played little sample riffs. So lots of times you hear Count Basie's his signature riff played at the end of all of the pieces. And you hear really sparse piano playing. Little sparse, little tasty kind of fills most of the time. He doesn't overplay, doesn't overstate.
Hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of good hors d'oeuvres. Yeah. Well, now we go to one of the other inimitable figures in jazz, Duke Ellington. We're going to hear a piece, it actually goes back a little further to 1926, but it's also swing. It's called East St. Louis, Toodaloo. Very moody, very atmospheric. Here's the sound. Well, in this trajectory of jazz history, what are we hearing there, Corey Combs?
Well, what's really unique about Ellington's band, especially in this early era, is he was writing music in what was called the jungle style, that he was trying to evoke tribal images. And it wasn't, if you heard the blues in the Count Basie band, as you said, you want to get up and do the swing dance, you really couldn't swing dance to this song. It's really trying to imitate... If you could hear, that was Bubber Miller on trumpet, and he was...
It's more like Tarzan.
Yeah, exactly. It's really trying to set up a different spirit, and he was very much trying to imitate the human voice on the trumpet, and that became one of Ellington's signature sounds. And, of course, this was a composer's band, as he worked with Billy Strayhorn throughout his career. This was a group that he composed for the individuals that were in his band for long stretches of time, and he really... became known as one of the first and greatest jazz composers of jazz history.
Corey Combs, again, is Director of Education for SF Jazz, and Dee Spencer is also with us here in studio, and we're going to hear some Bud Powell. Now, this is a big jump, 1951, but it's into bebop, and we're into the bebop sound now. Let's hear it. That's Un Poco Loco by Bud Powell, one of the really tragic figures of jazz, a genius and someone who was abused by the police. Many of you know his history. His music changed after that beating, and he's often overlooked as one of the founders. But here, Corey Combs, is where we can really start talking about improvisation.
Right, indeed. And also what's kind of unique about this clip is that while it's bebop and it's in the bebop vocabulary, you can hear the Cuban influence in this music, that it's when Dizzy Gillespie and others really started to travel to Cuba and hear those music and bring those musicians back to play with their bands. And so this was really a melding of cultural styles that the jazz musicians were the kind of the pioneers of that. But improvisation began to take the center stage, as you mentioned, that Bud Powell is one of the history's greatest improvisers, not just on the piano, but on any instrument. He's virtuosic, he's melodic, and he's people have tried to imitate him, but he's a hard one to imitate because of his technique and his depth of knowledge in terms of the harmonic structure, because they get very complicated as the beboppers start to write tough songs.
Well, talk about complicated structure and inimitable. We're going to move now a few years ahead. We're moving pretty quickly here. This is like a miniature Hamlet.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
well,
like
we're
that.
Going fast.
But this is 1957, and now we're going to hear Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. Let's hear this. Thelonious Monk with John Coltrane doing Nutty in 1957, and of course John Coltrane, one of the supreme figures in the world of jazz history. But let's talk with Dee about Thelonious Monk, who we shall not see his like again.
No, he just changed the whole landscape of piano for jazz performance. And after Thelonious Monk came onto the scene, everyone was just taken by storm. They either were trying to figure out what he was doing, imitate it, or they were trying to just count what he was doing and figure out how they could do things that were opposite him. And yeah, but his mark has been left, and everybody, you know, quotes Monk now. If you know anything about playing the piano and jazz, you have to quote Monk.
They're still trying to figure him out in some ways, aren't they? Quoting...
He's one of the most complicated and kind of divisive composers. I found that people love him with the kind of the greatest passion that they've expressed towards any musician, or they find him very inaccessible because he introduces dissonance. And, you know, one of his songs is called Ugly Beauty. So he really is not uncomfortable making an audience uncomfortable. He wants people to be challenged by what he's doing. And in fact, this is when we're really moving from jazz being popular music to jazz being art music, with musicians like Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk, that they're making artistic statements now and not just concerned with, is this music danceable? In fact, bebop is very not danceable, and so is Thelonious Monk's music. You really couldn't put a dancing couple behind that, what we just heard.
Well, notwithstanding the artistic side of this, or the artistic dimension of this, there's also a kind of American songbook parallel that moves right along with jazz, too.
Oh, indeed. You know, that's all the musicians, especially through the swing era, were playing Tin Pan Alley songs. They were playing Broadway songs. They were playing songs that dated back all the way to minstrel shows. And these songs became the songbook for American musicians. So really, while musicians like Fats Waller and Duke Ellington were composing, the majority of musicians were playing these standard songs like I've Got Rhythm or Body and Soul, and they were each trying to make their own statement. So if you take the song Body and Soul, Coleman Hawkins popularized that song because he made such an individual and unique statement on it that it was now Body and Soul by Coleman Hawkins, even though, of course, it wasn't written by him, but that was what became associated with
it. I was even thinking about Coltrane with Tea for Two.
Exactly.
And all that sort of thing. Well, let's hear some more. We're going to two. Now we're going to three. Bill Evans Trio, Solaire. This is 1961. Thank you. one of our more ambitious programs here on Forum. I mean, every program has its ambitions, but to try to go through a history of jazz like we're doing here.
One hour.
Streamlining here in an hour and all, and we're going to take your calls actually as well. In fact, I'd like to put the phone number out there now because certainly listeners are welcome to join us when we begin the interactivity of the program that we customarily do. And if you love something particularly in jazz or love something you've heard today, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you have questions about jazz and its history and you want to simply weigh in here, let me give you the phone number. It's 866-733-6786. It's toll-free, and you can use it whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, 866-733-6786. We'll get to your calls after the break, but again, you can call us now, and the email address, and we welcome your emails, is simply forum@kqed.org. Let's talk about Bill Evans, though, with Corey Combs and our jazz historian here, and Dee Spencer also with us in studio. That's conversation now.
Yeah, exactly. We're moving away from the rhythm section being timekeepers. They're not so much responsible for simply supporting the soloists. Now all three are equal participants in this conversation, as you mentioned, that Bill Evans leaves space for this, you know, another tragic figure, Scott LaFaro. He actually died in a car accident 10 days after this famous recording at the Village Vanguard. And drummer Paul Motion, who is still playing and doing wonderful music today, plays a lot with Joe Lovano and Bill Frisell, so he's very active. But this trio was a landmark trio. It's one of the most creative and the most influential piano trios. And, of course, Miles Davis loved Bill Evans. So many musicians see Bill Evans, like Monk, very different, but as influential in a lot of ways.
Well, another influential figure is Cannonball Adderley, and we thought we'd hear a little bit of that as we go out here. What we're going to hear in a minute is Sack of Woe, which was done in 1966, and this is a reaction to the kind of what's called the cool jazz movement, that is, taking the blues influence out of jazz.
Right. There was a lot of people, especially here in San Francisco on the West Coast, that were trying to combine the classical influence and the classical sounds with the jazz performance, and a lot of the New York hard bop kind of players were saying, we have to put the blues back into this music. That's where it came from. That's what it's about. And Cannonball, of course, is right there on the forefront of this.
Let's hear him. And when we come back, we'll hear some more. We'll also hear from you, our listeners. This is Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. If you've just joined us, we're doing, well, a course in jazz through the course of this hour, trying to give you the whole history in our own diminutive way. That was McCoy Tyner and John Coltrane doing Spiritual in 1961. And I want to mention that the SF Jazz Festival, which we've been talking about here as well, because both Corey Combs and Dee Spencer, who are with us this morning, are involved with that, feature Robbie Coltrane this year. son of John Coltrane. Still a Coltrane church going, I found out. Randy Newman will be at this festival, Dave Brubeck, Mavis Staples, Sweet Honey and the Rock, who've been featured on Forum. Lots of exciting stuff. Mitch Marcus. And let's find out about that piece, because there again we move along the trajectory historically, and what are we hearing that's different?
Well, what we had to bypass, you know, for time, of course, a lot, but one of the significant things, musical movements that starts to happen in this period is, of course, free jazz. And Ornette Coleman, Don Cherry, they became one of the most influential new directions in jazz after bebop. And so John Coltrane heard this music and really responded to it. But in addition, what was interesting about John Coltrane was he was bringing in his own spirituality to the music, which was not necessarily the first time we were hearing that, but it became almost exclusively how he tried to express himself, was through music and his own spirituality. So obviously the song being called Spiritual, it's a tribute to his own beliefs, and he really saw improvisation as almost a trance-like meditation, where there's stories of him playing at the Village Vanguard, playing one song for, you know, a full hour, an hour and a half, or and then just the whole band trying to keep up with his intensity and energy. So really, the doors just kind of blew wide open with John Coltrane, and especially this band with Elvin Jones and Jimmy Garrison and Eric Dolphy, who you heard on bass clarinet.
Do you know either of you a poet named Michael Harper?
No.
Who, Dear John, Dear Coltrane, mm-hmm. just wonderful poetry about Coltrane. Take us into that piece a little more. I mean,
sure.
If you can.
Sure. The beautiful thing about modal playing, which is one of the things that was pioneered by artists such as John Coltrane and here McCoy Tyner as well, is that it opens up the palette of the piano so that you're able to play various colors as opposed to chord progressions. So it really makes the piano more of an expressive painting instrument. So you're allowed to, like, you have just complete freedom over...
You know, those brushstrokes.
Yeah, mm. exactly.
Well, we're going to hear another part of that spiritual, and it's one of my favorite pianists, McCoy Tyner, playing, who, in fact, I saw at Yoshi's a number of years ago and was on the program. This is McCoy Tyner from, again, Spiritual, 1961. That again is McCoy Tyner playing on Spiritual, 1961. Corey Combs?
Yeah, what you're hearing there is in the left hand, with Dee's example, when she was playing kind of those pedal point, as you mentioned, painter strokes, and then that freed up his right hand, because we're really only talking about, my guess is this in D minor, is that right,
mm-hmm,
Dee?
D Dorian.
Yeah, so... we have, and this song probably extends to over 10 minutes, it's D, you know, it's all there is D. So when his left hand is going up and down and moving around those modes, his right hand is really free to color and do more active lines. But he's got a very distinct style that, again, was, he's not really thought of as much of a soloist as, say, a Bill Evans or even a Thelonious Monk, because his so, that pounding left hand in the Coltrane group became really synonymous with what McCoy Tyner was known for. But as you heard
that's
there...
That's his signature, really.
That's his signature.
That's his signature, yeah.
And now, speaking about signatures, a name that's familiar to many of you as we move toward our own contemporary period, here's Herbie Hancock, Watermelon Man by Herbie Hancock, 1973. Thank you. Danny Bringer getting mesmerized and intoxicated by this music. I hope our engineering is in continuing steady hands here. Dee Spencer, that's really the first time we hear electric keyboards. Huh?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And this was a revolutionary recording. I mean, this changed everybody's concept of playing keyboard. And the Fender Rhodes was the definitive instrument. You had to get your hands on a big Fender Rhodes keyboard in order to sound like Herbie Hancock. So everybody went in that direction. And they're still today trying to go into that direction.
And we spoke about the late Grover Sales, dear friend of mine who you work with teaching out of San Francisco State. Grover used to get people all ticked off because he'd come on the radio and he'd badmouth rock and roll and say jazz is really the great music and then the music for the gods and all that. But this is rock and roll becoming part of jazz, really.
Absolutely. And the marriage between the two is even, you know, prevalent today. This was the beginning of a very exciting period, you know, for music, for American music, I feel.
Yeah.
Want anything, Corey?
Well, only that, of course, when we're talking about jazz rock, we have to talk about Miles Davis, who, you know, he was at the forefront of this. And, of course, both John Coltrane and Herbie Hancock and Bill Evans, you know, played with Miles Davis. So
I remember Bitches Brew. I mean,
Then, you know, he was one of the first to use electronic instruments. And then Keith Jarrett, of course, who is now we really associate with traditionalism, was, of course, he played electronic keyboards with Miles' band and played on Bitches Brew, too. So.
Well, we're going to save Keith Jarrett because we're going to go to some calls now.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Let's do that through this course in jazz. Michael, good morning.
Hey, Michael, how you doing?
Hi.
It's always great to hear you. And I always learn a new word from you to extend my vocabulary. I listen every day.
Now, what was it today?
The point I wanted to make was I thought that they really missed an important paradigm in the evolutionary of the music, especially on keyboard, and that was Dick Spiderbeck. He composed two pieces of music on the keyboard in the 20s. That was the first example of using extended chords like, 13ths and 8ths. And that, In a Mist was one, and another was Flashes. And are you still there, Mike?
Yeah, I'm listening to you. We're all listening to you with all of our attention here. You're right to bring up Spiderbeck, though. I mean, very important figure. Do you want to talk about it?
Sure. I mean, the relationship between Dick Spiderbeck's playing, his trumpet, of course, he revolutionized the trumpet because during that particular period, he was one of the people who played really in a sort of a cool style, pretty much ahead of his time. And you're right, he did use the use of 13ths and other, because he was inspired by the extended harmonies of Ravel and Debussy. So you're correct in bringing up, you know, his relationship with the development.
And we thank the caller, Michael, and we move on to another caller, and that's Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how's it going, Michael?
It's going. We're doing a whole course, a whole history of jazz here.
I was trying to sleep in, but waking up to Duke Ellington is a privilege. The one way I've only been able to describe jazz is in this metaphor that jazz is like the ocean. It has deep parts and shallow parts, and it's full of pretty fish, and some of them can eat you. But
what about the pollution?
Let's not get into the pollution. But I was wondering how you feel about the mighty Sachemundo, how he stands up. Even though he did so much to explode jazz,
You're talking about Louis Armstrong, I take it.
Sachemundo.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. We were talking about Grover Sales. You can't make up stories like this. Grover Sales told me when he gave a test on the history of jazz at San Francisco State, a student wrote down that Louis Armstrong was a Native American, and he said to the student, where did you come up with this? And he swore to me that this was true. The student said, you said he was a seminal figure. Now,
Oh boy!
I know it sounds like a bad joke, but he swore it was true. But I mean, when you see Ken Burns' history, you see how important Louis Armstrong was. Even though, you know, to some, when Charlie Parker came around, you know, he was that old time stuff already, right?
Yeah. But it's again, as we're doing an hour, of course, we're living out, you know, major figures, figures, and of course Louis Armstrong. We wouldn't have any of these musicians that we're talking about that followed him without him. Big Spiderbeck is another one that what he did to bring improvisation to the table, his sound, his range, the bands he played and created, and the length of his career, the fact that even when swing and bebop was going, he was still playing and he was still a popular figure. That's one thing to really emphasize, that, you know, as the avant-gardists came, as jazz rock came, it's not as if the people that played swing style just stopped playing, or, you know, people that were influenced by you know, people like Louis Armstrong. It's he was and still is highly, highly influential.
Well, he's a seminal figure, yeah, as we said. Here's Carl, who writes, "Thank you for your condensed program on the history of jazz piano. I have been studying jazz piano with Rebecca Mollian Santana at San Francisco City College, which has a very good music program, by the way. And I have a question for your resident pianist. I've been learning that jazz pianists play in modes rather than keys, and I was wondering if, in a few words, your instructor from San Francisco State could explain jazz piano modes a little better. What is a jazz mode C?"
Sure. Well, as you know, there are modes or scales, just another word for scales. And just like you have the major scale, which is the Ionian mode, you have several other modes. You have seven modes all, you know, all together. And what these do is they give you the freedom to play within the context of the chord changes. So you have to be the person to decide which mode you want to manipulate to express yourself improvisationally.
And here's John, who says, "I'd love to hear comments about the evolution of the solo piano from the early stride pianists like Willie the Lion Smith through Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson to Keith Jarrett." And he says, "Everybody digs Bill Evans, but, you know, let's hear a Jarrett cut." And in fact, we can come back and talk about Keith Jarrett. This is If I Should Lose You. This is 1983. That, again, is the Keith Jarrett Trio doing If I Should Lose You. Well, we're right up to 1983 here, Corey.
But in a way, we're really going back. So that the significance of that is that it's only 10 years after Headhunters. And there was a whole lot of jazz that was happening in the 80s that, you know, that's when a lot of people either feel that jazz lost its soul because it went, you know, too far into the fusion jazz rock. And then there was, of course, people like Wynton and Branford Marsalis who began to bring back the traditional movement. And, of course, Keith was one that said, "I'm never going to play an electric keyboard again. After playing with Miles, I'm done with it." So he began playing with this standards trio, and that's sometimes they do some originals or some improvised music, but most of it goes back to that great American songbook, like what, you know, what Fats Waller was playing, what you know, the stride pianists were playing. He's not playing in a stride style anymore, but it's the same source material.
You know, you mentioned Wynton Marsalis. When he was on Forum, we were talking about the fact that he brought back all this great classical jazz and, you know, made it really a part of the conversation again, musically as well as verbally. But he came under some criticism, particularly because he seemed to be ignoring some of the newer jazz artists. Yeah, well, I wonder what you two feel about that.
Dee, you want to?
Well, you're always going to have an open dialogue about jazz. I think that's the beauty of it, is that jazz is everybody's music and everybody's entitled to an opinion about it. So I think as long as we keep the discussions going, keep the table open, the music will remain exciting.
Well, we're talking about jazz, and by the way, in the time remaining, if you'd like to join the program, you're certainly welcome to do so. It's toll-free 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, and we'll go to Castro Valley and welcome Richard. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I cut my eye teeth on the West Coast music, much maligned, and I have an observation and a question. The observation is that there seems to be a dearth of young, I'm talking about local folks because I'm involved with a lot of minor promotions, a real dearth, alarming to me, of young black artists, one. And the question is, regardless of what their color is, where are these young cats going to find work anymore? I mean, I can tell you that we have a plethora, and Dee Spencer, who I've heard at the Dog Patch, could attest to this. But where are these people going to find paying jobs to put food on the table? And I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
All right. We thank you for the call. Well, we've done shows on jazz, and this has come up before. And Dee, I know you've got some thoughts about it.
Well, it's it's up to the artist. I tell all my students, you have to kind of figure this out. This is part of learning your art, part of learning your craft, is you have to figure out what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And you've got to come up with a way to do it. And that's the challenge.
Yeah.
That's the challenge.
It is challenging, particularly now when jazz clubs are closing their doors, even though there's still a lot of aficionados out there and a lot of passion for jazz. Here's a listener who says, great program this morning. Can your guest comment on the place of Art Tatum in the history of jazz and anything about his musical technique, approach, and influence? Corey?
Yeah, well, I'm doing, as you mentioned in the beginning, this series on Discover Jazz. We have our last class tonight at the Jewish Community Center. And we did a class in the middle called Our Unclassifiable Innovators, which included Thelonious Monk and Art Tatum. Because Art Tatum, while he comes from the Stride tradition, there's a great, I'm not going to quote it absolutely right, but there's a great quote from, I'm sorry, I'm spacing the name, I'll get it. But it's basically like there was piano before Art Tatum, and then there was everything after. he was revolutionary. He was...
That's what we call sui generis.
Yeah, he was an incredible, incredible technician. Of course, mostly blind, and so there's great stories of him going into the studio and recording all his solo recordings in one take.
But you're right to bring up this. In fact, I'm sure it's part of your education, Jazz, how arbitrary some of the labels are and difficult to pin these things down stylistically.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Tatum is the epitome of that. It's also sometimes confusing to know what's African and what's American when you're deciding between the hyphenated. We're going to hear some Art Tatum. Let's do that. Tatum, I'll see you in my dreams. And of course, you mentioned his blindness, which was part of the novelty of a blind piano player like Ray Charles.
Right, indeed.
Go ahead, Corey.
Well, what you're also hearing there is he listened to Debussy. So it's not only was he listening, a lot of these musicians were classically trained, which I'm finding when doing a lot of research for this class that the ones that are considered the true organic virtuosos had some classical background. And while Art Tatum wouldn't necessarily be seen as a classical technician, the things he's doing, there's pianists that would come to see him that classically trained pianists. Horowitz, right, and that just could not fathom what was happening there.
A lot of that is just a sense of the versatility of what he could do in melding classical with jazz. Let's go to our callers. Jack, hi.
I was a couple comments. First, Wes Montgomery and the influence of jazz guitar in the music, and also West Coast jazz. Although Jerry Mulligan wasn't from the West Coast, he was really influential on the people on this side of the continent.
Well, he spent a lot of time here, that's for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. It's good points on both, and thank you for that, Jack. Get another caller on here. Who wants to talk about the importance of knowing the blues to play jazz? Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Yes. I'm just curious to know how important it is to know the blues to play jazz, because I've switched up my style of play to learn the blues, because everybody I'm talking to that plays the blues and also people that I talk to that plays the jazz is telling me it's very important to know blues because blues and jazz is connected.
Connected at the hip and many other parts of the anatomy, huh, Dee?
You got to have a little bit of blues in your jazz. Yeah, that's right.
There's your answer, and we thank you for
thank
the call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. In fact, the kind of music that we call jazz, it's indigenous, as I said in my introduction. It goes back really to, to what used to be called Negro music, Negro spirituals and all that. I mean, it really has its birth in the blues, but it goes even before that. Right? That's the ancestry.
That's right. Blues, gospel, spirituals. Yeah, they all have to be there. You've got to have some field cries, field hollers, some call and response. Yeah. Got to have those elements.
Well, we were talking about spiritual jazz before with Coltrane, and how jazz has changed has been really the theme of this hour. Here's Ahmad Jamal. Let's set that up a little bit, Corey Combs, because it takes us in a couple of different directions.
Well, Ahmad Jamal's trio is, again, I don't want to call him underrated, because when people know Ahmad Jamal, they respect and see what a genius he is. I think he's just maybe not as known as he should be, because the things he was doing in terms of trio interplay and the way he was playing the piano and approaching playing a melody. So again, he was most often playing this Great American Songbook, but we're leaving the idea that to state a melody, you have to play it all. So for example, he might play the first phrase of a melody and then leave the rest to your imagination, assuming that as a sophisticated listener, you're going to know the vocabulary, you're going to know the song, and you're just going to be able to recognize that, okay, I don't need to play the whole song anymore. That really, we're going to do more in the improvisation section, and then all this really fantastic rhythmic hits between the drums and the bass and the piano that sets up the rhythmic motion, which becomes equally important to the melodic statement.
Here he is, Ahmad Jamal. Ahmad Jamal, I'll see you in my dreams. And,
It could happen to you.
I mean, it could happen to you. Excuse me. We already heard I'll see you in my dreams. But again, we're taking popular music again, like we were with I'll see you in my dreams. And we're going to take another call. Eric, join us. Good morning. Eric, you're on.
Oh, hello. It's ambitious to hit all of the great jazz pianists in 1 hour. You did mention Oscar Peterson. But didn't play any cuts. I could recommend Oscar Peterson, and along with Count Basie, The Timekeepers is just a delicious example of music that will become a favorite for everyone. Also, I'd love to hear some Joseph Zawinul or Chick Corea, which, of course, the fusion that started with got their start with Miles, and that's just lovely polyrhythmic example of jazz piano.
Would that we could sample all of those artists and many others that have been named and that I'm getting emails for, and favorite artists and all that sort of thing. Yeah. But we've covered a lot of territory here, and like I said from the beginning, it's been very ambitious. Let's talk about some of those figures he mentioned, particularly Oscar Peterson, who was a great pianist.
Yeah, it's an omission by time, not by choice. He's trio format. Early trio was with guitar, bass and piano, as opposed to drums, bass and piano, and that was a pretty unique thing. And Nat King Cole did that as well, but those are the two, the guitar, piano, bass trios that really stand out in jazz history, and it gives an immediate, intimate feeling. And then, in fact, when Herb Ellis couldn't play with that group anymore, Herb Ellis or Joe Pass?
Joe Pass.
Yeah, both of them. But when those they moved on, they felt, well, we just can't replace those sounds, so they brought in Egg Thigpen, the drummer, and went to a more traditional, like we just heard with Ahmad Jamal. Mm-hmm. But, tragic loss in terms of history of jazz, recent loss.
Yeah.
We can get another caller on here. Robin, join us.
Hi. I've not read the whole program, but what I was wondering is, why isn't Hoagy Carmichael ever mentioned with jazz pianists, jazz singing, these canon of music, Georgia, Skylark is still one of the best melodic and adaptable songs ever, and it's been sung by everybody, but he just seems to get lost in the whole mix.
I'm glad you brought it up. It's one of my all-time favorites, and the old riddle used to be, what's the they would ask you the other side of Stardust on 45s. It was the biggest selling record of all time, and nobody would know it, you know, because of the other side of Stardust. It's been a lot of fun. Corey Combs, thank you. Director of Education, SF Jazz. Dee Spencer, who directs the jazz program at SF State and SF Jazz All-Star High School Ensemble. We're going to go out with a little Horace Silver here and Blowing the Blues Away.
Thank you so much for having us.
Forum Senior Editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our interns, Sarah Bahat, Susan Bertan, Tariq Fauda, Aliyah Madyun, Kelly Pretzer, Jeanette Yu. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.